You're listening to Words and Music, an audio series exploring the life and work of Indiana writers. The nonprofit arts and humanities organization Big Car Collaborative produces this show and it airs first on 99.1 WQRT LP Indianapolis. Words and Music is made possible by Indiana Humanities. I'm Oreo Jones and I will be your host for this episode. I sit down with award-winning Afrofuturist writer, community organizer, and teacher Maurice Broaddus. With a dozen novels and nearly 100 short stories in print, we sat down to discuss the origins and the evolutions of Afrofuturism, his work with the iconic Marvel Comics, Broaddus' community work here in Indianapolis, and his latest novel, Sweep of Stars, part one of his epic space opera. This episode also features excerpts and quotes from author and pioneer of the genre, Octavia Butler, voiced by artist Yebsera Tab.
I wasn't born in America.
Yeah, you were born in London,
right?
Yeah.
And so my family came over when I was pretty young. You know, they put me into the school system and didn't know what grade to put me in. Mm. And so they skipped me, like I was young, but they skipped me into a second grade. And then they were like, we should probably put him in third, but... Yeah, he's already the smallest kid in the class, so let's keep him in second grade. But my teacher, I'll never forget her, is Miss Rainey. Never forgot her. But she gives me the stack of paper and then sets me in the back of the class and goes, yeah, you're basically just going to create this year. And I just start thinking, man, the American school system is great. And that's all I did. That whole year, all I did was I just wrote little stories. I wrote poems. I even made a little prayer book. I remember writing this prayer book and then giving it to Miss Rainey. And so that's all it is. And I think what was key for that is just inspired this love of writing in me, where it's like not writing for school or anything. It's not writing as punishment. It's just writing just for the sake of writing. Mm-hmm. And I've always sort of carried that in me. And the other thing I carry in me is my mother, because she's from Jamaica. Mm. And so she'd always spin these stories for us, you know, these... Actually, I think back and like these are some terrifying stories that she would spin us as like bedtime stories, right? But you know, she tells these stories and everything, these Obia stories, these Duppy stories, all these kind of stories, but her thing was like, this is how we pass down our culture. You know, we didn't have TV and radio and internet. We told stories to one another to pass our culture down from one generation to the next. And so that sort of instilled a love of stories in me on top of all of that. And so I just sort of carried all of that with me. I've had some good teachers along the way. I know my high school teachers really encouraged me to do writing. And when I got into college, even though I was supposed to not pursue a degree in creative writing, but I still took a lot of writing classes and my professors were just really encouraging for me. So then when I got out, I was just like, hey, I'm gonna do this thing. So even though I was I was a scientist at the time. Mm. But all the time I'm like trying to figure out, how can I get some writing done? How can I tell stories? And then it just became my practice after that. I think I saw my first story in 1999 to a little known magazine called Hoods.
Cool.
With a Z.
With a Z. Yeah,
that's how you knew it was authentic.
Yeah.
It was Hoods.
Yeah. That's what's up. So it sounds like it wasn't really that gnarly of a transition. Like you had it going on when you came to the States and you were just writing and writing. It was just almost like an exercise and a form of enjoyment.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, but in college, my mother wanted me to major in something what she called respectable. And our compromise was me being a biology major. So that's why I have a degree in biology and I had a career as a scientist for a long time. Mm. But that's also when I realized I have to write. So, I mean, I'd set down my pen in my freshman year of college, but by my junior year, I'd picked that pen back up and I was writing stories again, not for class, not for any reason, just because I have to get these stories out of me. Mm. And so I just start writing these stories. And then after a while, I was just like, let me go ahead and take some classes while I'm here. Use my electives to take some creative writing classes. But I'm like, I have to do this. So I started writing my first novel in 1993, right?
Okay, yeah, yeah.
It takes me like 7 years before I finish this first draft of this novel, which we'll never see the light of day. But it was my first. It was mine. It was my first novel. And... So I finished the first draft, and then the second year, I'm like, all right, let me do my big revision. I do this massive rewrite on this book, and I remember when I wrote the end on the rewrite of the book. It was May 13th, 2001. Mm. And the reason I know that date so precisely is because my wife was in labor, And I'm like, honey, if you can just, I don't know, squeeze your legs together or something. I am almost done with this book. And then once it's out of my head, I can be completely devoted. And so I get to the end and I'm like, how far are the contraction? She's like, oh, we're running at about 2 minutes each. And I'm like, oh, all right, let's go to the hospital. We get to the hospital and they're like, oh no, we can't give you any medicine. You just got to go deliver this thing natural. It's too late for that. And so, I remember the look she gave me in that moment, but I'm like, honey, I'm a writer.
What was the first subject matter? Like, what were those stories? What were you writing about when you, in those early stages when you're like, yo, I'm about to be a writer.
When I first was really falling in love with reading and writing all that stuff, and genre in particular, mm-hmm. like my high school teachers, they'd give me books like on, gave me Dracula and gave me, and I really imprinted on Edgar Allan Poe, which coincided with my bad poetry phase in high school. You know, that phase we go through. Yeah. I'm wearing all black and like, you know, I'm staring into the abyss, you know, that kind of poetry. And so I imprinted on Edgar Allan Poe and then moved from him to Stephen King and then from Stephen King to Neil Gaiman. And so, and this is when I'm starting to seriously think up through writing and everything. But the big question I started wrestling with was, you know, what does it look like for me as a black man? What do those stories kind of look like? Mm-hmm. And so those are things I start wrestling with. And so that's when I start reading folks like Octavia Butler and Toni Morrison and Walter Mosley. You know, he had a huge impact on me as a writer. And so like the first story that got sold is called Soul Food. And there's this creature in folklore called the Sin Eater. And so Soul Food was basically this sort of Sin Eater in the Hood type novel. I mean, short story, mostly told in the main setting was with the barbershop. Because if something's going to go down in the neighborhood, you know, the barbershop's going to be the place to get the 411 on all sure, of it. Right? Yeah, yeah. And so that's what the story is about. That, you know, this guy trying to figure out what this creature is that's stalking the neighborhood, but it, you know. The story playing out mostly in the barbershop. Mm. And that's kind of laid a lot of the foundation for the type of writing I ended up doing because, you know, I love folklore and mythology, you know, those sort of things. But I write at that community neighborhood level. So
let's talk about the genre of Afrofuturism. You know, we talk about Octavia Butler.
All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The one lasting truth is change.
The Staples, Mark Derry, in 94, coined the phrase Afrofuturism, or had the essential, a essay.
Yeah.
Black to the Future.
Back to the Future.
Yeah.
And so it was this lament. Because you know he's you know looking through the genre, he's just like, look, there. I don't know why black folks aren't more in this genre. Because right now, all I'm seeing is Octavia Butler, Samuel Delaney, Charles Saunders, and Stephen Barnes. Mm-hmm. That's who he name checks in the essay. And he's just like, I don't know why I'm not seeing more black folks wrestling in this area of genre.
Why aren't there more science fiction black writers? There aren't, because there aren't. What we don't see, we assume can't be. What a destructive assumption.
And that's why I mentioned Walter Mosley, because I was reading Afrofuturism, didn't realize I was reading Afrofuturism at the time, because I wasn't familiar with the label. Mm-hmm. The label really sprung into public consciousness when Black Panther came out, mm-hmm. and people were like, we need a name for what to call what it is we're watching, and it's like, yeah, Afrofuturism, this term's been around since 93, but glad y'all are finally arriving at the party. Walter Mosley wrote this short story. Now, Walter Mosley is mostly known as a crime fiction writer. Mm. That's how most people know him. But Walter Mosley is a huge sci-fi guy. And the book that I, the first Walter Mosley, I didn't even know him. As much as I love crime fiction, I didn't know him as a crime fiction writer. I knew him from this book called Futureland. And it was this book of nine interconnected short stories. And I'm reading this book and I'm like, whoa, we can do this? We can do this. I mean, he was creating this massive, intricate world. You know, it's controlled by corporations, but you have all these black geniuses underground that are doing all this technology and all this kind of other stuff that's impacting the world in ways that and people can't figure out what's going on. And I'm just like, oh yeah, this is what I want to do. this right here is what I want to do. And that was probably my introduction to Afrofuturism right there.
Yeah, it's stories and representation and worlds that are created in the conscious of Black America.
Right.
You know, right. Taking Absolutely. Parallels, taking elements mm-hmm. and creating a universe, you know, that yeah. is far beyond our time.
Right. Right. The way I look at it is, you know, it's stories that are rooted in the past, that critique the present, but are always looking towards the future. I have a friend, her name's Tanana Reeve Dew, a great writer. And she said that the act of imagining ourselves in the future is the first act of resistance. And I've always carried that quote with me. I'm just like, yeah, that's what it's about. And, you know, just having these stories spring from the wellspring of Black imagination. I'm just like, yeah, this is where I want to be.
I got this quote from Greg Tate. It says, Black people live in alienation that sci-fi writers imagine.
And yet it's always been with us.
Yeah.
So, you know, I look back at the music of Sun Ra, for example, and his orchestra.
Yeah.
You know, and the mythology he created around himself and as a jazz musician in the 50s. But, you know, you talk to him, he's like, no, I'm not from here. Mm-hmm. I'm from Titan. I'm from Saturn. You know, that's where, and our people's destiny is in the stars. Or you get Parliament Funkadelic, you know, with the mothership connection and the mythology they spin around themselves. Mm. And you know, all the way through to Andre 3000 and Outkast,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Right? Because even what you were just talking about feeling aliens and feeling like we're trapped in this construct, and that's all that he was talking. Andre 3000 was rapping about in AT Aliens. Mm-hmm. That was his whole thing. Is like, you know, we're here in the society we didn't create. We're aliens. We're outcasts. We're on the side, but you know, we're here to dream of a better future. We're here to build a better future, mm-hmm. and that's like the underlying theme of that whole project.
Yeah, going back to Sun Ra, was reading this, you know, kind of like origin of where he's, you know, in down in the South, and he gets abducted mm-hmm. by aliens, mm-hmm. and then he comes with a message saying, "I'm taking my people to another world to escape
right.
the prejudices." The racism, the violence, mm-hmm. And I think that's just such a powerful origin story
right.
that you could even relate to here and the future right now.
Oh, absolutely!
Yeah,
absolutely.
If I told you I'm from outer space, you wouldn't want to believe a word I said, would you? Why should you? You've lost your way. You should have nothing to say. You lost your celestial rights. You can't go to Jupiter. You can't even go to Mars. You can't go to any other of the planets and out in the stars. You lost your heavenly rights. You are chained and bound to planet Earth. You're a children of the sun. Children of the sun. Each and every one. Of the child of the sun. You're a children of the sun. Children of the sun. Each and every one. Of the child of the sun. Children of the sun. Children of the sun. Each and every one. Of the child of the sun. Each and every one. Of the child of the sun. You're a children of the sun. Children of the sun. Each and every one. Of the child of the sun.
In 99, Missy Elliott, that music video is insane. Like, you know, with the imagery and the costume design, the sound design, which is crazy because you look back and this is like in the 90s mm-hmm. and it's almost even ahead of its time, right, still to this day,
right,
in the 2020s.
Yeah, she went on a run. I think she had like 4 or 5 videos in a row where I'm just like, what is she on?
Right. Like her and Hype Williams, right, just like,
yeah, and crazy. Where is she at and how can I get there? That's pretty much all I was doing. Every video that she was putting out.
It's such a beautiful thing to see just the evolution of the genre and just to see and people being inspired and creating these universes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll back up one more music example. Janelle Monáe, and the reason she comes to mind, well, A, because she was building worlds with her music, and I think her original series of albums was supposed to be all set in this one universe that takes place in the near future, following this rogue android through her experiences with love and all that kind of mm-hmm. stuff. But the reason she came to mind again was because, one, I mean, besides the music, she did end up putting out what is it, her emotion picture. It was like an hour long music video of a whole album that she did. But then most recently, actually the same month that my novel Sweep of Stars came out, she put out a short story collection, The Memory Computer, I believe it's called. And it's another collection of short stories. All the stories are collaborations with other Afrofuturists that all take place in the universe she created with her music. And so I'm just like, yeah, that's. That'll stretch me. I love being pushed, and I'm like, okay.
That's some inspo.
Right. I see what you did there. Let me step my game up now.
Listen. Thinking will only make it harder. It's best if you just enjoy the process. Accept it. People used to work so hard to be free. But we're lucky here. All we have to do is forget. But I don't want to forget you. You don't have a choice.
Is it like, and why is it important that you do what you do here in Indiana, in the city of Indianapolis?
All right, so one of the things I say a lot is I write for me. You know, I'm not trying to write to a market. I'm not trying to write to a genre. I'm in love with story. I'm trying to get stories out. I'm trying to tell stories. And I'm my primary audience, because there's always stuff that I'm trying to work out for myself. And it just comes out. I do it through words. So that's one thing. So it's like, so put a pin in that. And then I just love the city of Indianapolis. One of the reasons I love Indianapolis so much is because I say that it's America in microcosm. So when we look at the picture of the history of America, and all the things that America's been through, all that's present here in Indianapolis. So the more I deconstruct Indianapolis, the more I examine and pick apart its history, the relationships in Indianapolis, even from a neighborhood level, from an individual level, neighborhood level, citywide level, on up, the more I do that work, the more I'm sort of revealing all of that on a day-to-day basis, you know, systemic basis, all those things are in play in Indianapolis. So why not interrogate that? And plus, since I live here, Indianapolis has formed a big part of my identity. So me interrogating Indianapolis is still me interrogating my identity and my history, even through through the setting in which I find myself in. So it's all that sort of stuff, you know, all rolled up into one. And I think my career really started taking off when I got really embedded. So going back to our definition of Afrofuturism, one of the things about Afrofuturism is art meets social practice. And I think that's an element that people tend to forget. It meets social practice. And then once my career did that, that's when I think things sort of really gelled for me. So, I mean, I had a novel a couple novels ago, Pimp My Airship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And,
beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I won the Indiana Authors Award for that one. But at the heart of that book is about a poet who finds himself in this retro-futuristic setting. And he's just like, you know, I'm a poet, and that's all I do. I've carved out this little safe space for me in this world. I'm just a poet, right? But the whole the book is about his journey into what does it look like to use your art to make change in your community? What does it look like to leverage your art to make changes in the world, you know, and have an impact and let your voice be heard? That was literally the question I was thinking through at the time. It's like, man, I'm a writer, but I want to leave the world a better place. But how do I do that if I'm just a storyteller? Well, then I end up hanging out with a group here called The Learning Tree. And all of a sudden, my writing is meeting a social practice. And, like, things start to come together for me. And I move from working with The Learning Tree to working with the Kepler Institute. And then it's just all starting to, you know, and I'm staying in that social practice of, like, I have my art, but I have my community, and I'm living out what it is we say we believe. Mm. And so that's when I think things really started to come together for me. In fact, that's why my novel, Sweep of Stars, is basically an examination of the work that Kepra does, just projected 100 years with Kepra as a, you know, an intergalactic community as one thinks of it.
Yeah. Would you mind touching on a little bit of what you do with Kepra and kind of like your history with that organization?
Oh, sure,
yeah.
Sure. So I'm Kepra's resident Afrofuturist.
Yeah.
And the way I talk about it is like I'm the resident Afrofuturist, but I work among other Afrofuturists, right? That they might not always describe themselves that way, but it's like, no, I'm working along other Afrofuturists. And what I mean by that is I'm working beside other folks in the community who are dreaming of worlds that could be and working towards those futures. So they are literally working to create the futures they want to see. So whatever their desired future states are, it's like, how do we get that work going now to get to that point? So I'm like, it's me working alongside other Afrofuturists. My main role over there is I'm the facilitator for an arts organization called Cafe Creative. And so it's me vibing with other artists as we figure out what does it mean to be artists in relationship with one another, and what's the power we could find by just being, you know, in relationship, creating opportunities for one another, encouraging one another, and like literally relationship is the basis of the organization, right? And out of those relationships, we see what can happen. So what projects could happen.
All right, so let's talk Sweep of Stars, your latest Afrofuturist space opera.
Because I love Indianapolis and because I center it, even though I end up in the course of my work, I recognize I do a lot of horrible things to Indianapolis also, but it's out of love. It's out of love. And so even when I first started writing, because this is so editors were joking with me. It's like, yeah, you're writing a space opera now. How are you going to squeeze Indianapolis into that? And I'm like, oh, really? Challenge accepted. All right, so Earth, yeah, let me throw in a couple climate disasters, some global reshaping, and I will make Indianapolis the capital of Earth. Problem solved, and go. So so Sweep of Stars is book one of my Astro Black trilogy.
Yeah.
Right. And so, and you know, it's loosely based on a, you know, Kepra, the Kepra Institute, if it was an intergalactic, you know, community. And it's a, it basically follows three storylines. So one is the story of Mungano, the founding elders, you know, trying to figure out how do we pass our traditions down to the next generation? What does that passing of the torch look like? And so you have that. So then we have there's a generational starship called the Cypher, which is my starship powered by jazz music.
That's right.
Yeah. Because it's my world and I can do what I want.
Yeah.
And you'll hear threads of the fact that, you know, the Titan is a big part of the Mungano alliance. Well, Titan being a moon of Saturn in a, with the starship powered by jazz music. I mean, I basically have stamped Sun Ra all over this book and the storyline. And then the third storyline is, so there's this wormhole that that the community is exploring in secret. So they have their military unit exploring on the other side of the wormhole. And I ain't gonna lie, that so that whole storyline is just is my space to hide all of my hip hop references. I mean, if you read that storyline and go, oh, all right, yeah, this brother loves hip hop. Classic 90s hip hop, that's riddled all through that old storyline. So intertwine those three stories and, you know, that's a Sweep of Stars.
You want to read an excerpt?
Sure. So this is a paraphrase, well, not really paraphrase, but it's out of chapter one of Sweep of Stars. This is the introduction. One of the things is, so I have like seven different points of view characters in the course of the book. But the first one is, well, actually, she'll tell you herself. Your name is Leah Adisa, for now. Choosing a name for yourself is not something to be entered into lightly. It's a promise you make to the universe, or it to you. A name is a story of yourself you present to the world, a label to define you. That's the entire point of the naming ceremony. You are finally of age to interpret yourself and enter into the Mungano community as a full, free member. Now, because this is an Adisa renaming, the entire Ijo governing body travels in from all over the Mungano Alliance. The sovereign territory of Mungano centers around the lunar outpost and the facility which serves as its capital, the Dreaming City. Named after an old tale the wise ones whispered when it was time for bed, a place full of Orisha and magic in the old ways. From Bronzeville on Mars, Titan, and even the distant Oijiji mining outpost, members make the voyage. It's only a couple of weeks light travel at sublight, but many representatives wanted to make the pilgrimage. Even the fabled research ship, the Cypher, is due to dock at any time now. The members of Mungano experienced two naming ceremonies. You don't remember your first. It came 7 days after your birth on original Earth. By the hollow accounts, family and neighbors gathered together to celebrate and welcome you into the world, imitating the rituals they heard were carried out on Mungano. You were given the name of a distant ancestor in your family. It's only fitting that you chose Ojobo, the day of creation, for the day of your second. You love landing into the Dreaming City. As your Sakara shuttle ship disembarks from the array, the two bisecting arms known as the belts span the circumference of the moon in a curving perpendicular lattice looming over you. A string of crawls arranged in a long line, the series of modules gird the moon in a geosynchronous orbit over the Dreaming City. Descending on a vector to the building with spires radiating from its dome, the many-rayed architecture made it appear like a setting sun coming into view. With its giant columns, skyports, and blur of lights, it's a gleaming bauble filling the horizon. Still, you yearn for more. The stars call to you. If not Mars, then certainly Titan, or maybe worlds beyond. You dream of a truly outer space and the magic of the stars.
You have like thousands and thousands of comic books, right? What's the number at?
So I had to quit collecting.
Yeah, that's right.
I quit collecting about the time my second son was born. That'd be like 2002. I quit collecting, and my wife was like, "All right, look, real talk. You can either, you know, feed your children or keep buying comic books, but you can't do both." And I'm like, "All right, well, let me pray about it. All right, I guess I'll feed the kids." And but when I quit, I was at about 20,000 comic books.
Wow.
So That's crazy. So I have them in my office right now. They're all bagged, sealed, alphabetized.
Yeah. Minted.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You've done work with Marvel, Tales of Wakanda.
Yeah, you shouldn't put that in past tense, but maybe that's a different conversation.
Yeah. Let's talk about Tales of Wakanda.
Okay.
Right now.
For now.
Because you can't. We don't want the Marvel police.
Right, yeah. You signed NDAs, brought us. Like, okay. Okay, let me respect those.
That's crazy. That's awesome. Congrats, man.
Thank you.
Like, Tales of Wakanda. I mean, Nikki Giovanni is on it. There's a whole bunch of, you know, it's just a compilation of different short stories.
Right.
In the Black Panther universe, mm-hmm. How was it like, you know, trying to tap into that and being able to, you know, actually mold a story?
Yeah.
That's a dream, right?
It's absolutely. So it's a twofold dream because you mentioned Nikki Giovanni. The rest of that table of contents, those are my writing heroes.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly I'm being published alongside my writing heroes. I mean, I mentioned Tananarive Reeve Due, you know, Sheree Renee Thomas, Linda Addison. I mean, these are my writing heroes that all of a sudden I'm published alongside. So that's one thing. But then, yeah, I mean, again, if we were having this conversation in my office, A, we'd be surrounded by the 20,000 comic books.
Yeah.
And then B, you would see all kinds of Black Panther figures around that place.
Yeah.
Because Black Panther is my favorite superhero character.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to write Black Panther, in fact, for Marvel to go, hey, can you write Black Panther for us? So that's them reaching out to me. To go, can you write Black Panther? And I'm like, yeah. And I, like I said, I love that. I have like his very first appearance in Fantastic Four. So I go all the way back with Black Panther. And so, you know, so I get to reread some of my favorite Black Panther runs to develop this story that is essentially about Black Panther and his half brother, Hunter, who's known as the White Wolf in the comic book. So I get to write about their relationship, the name of the story is Kindred Spirits, but I mean, it's all about this sibling rivalry between the two of them as told through the eyes of Queen Divine Justice, who is a teenager from Chicago who is found to be a member of the Dora Milaje. She just didn't know it, but mm-hmm. she's from that bloodline.
Okay.
So she's just been recently transported to Wakanda. She's still trying to figure out what this means for her life. And she gets to narrate the story about these two brothers who, one is the king, one is the head of the secret police, and, you know, at his heart, it's the tale of these two brothers trying to figure out how to love and be with one another.
Mm-hmm.
But the greater story, which is the backdrop of that story, is the whole idea of examining the relationship of what goes on in Africa. And so in this case, I have China, who's been doing a lot of the infrastructure projects in a lot of the countries in Africa, which is something that's currently going on as a way to, again, continue to mine resources out of Africa. Like, oh, yeah, we'll take care of your infrastructure. Just let us have this and this and this. And so in the story, China's providing infrastructure for all the countries that border Wakanda.
Mm-hmm.
Then come to find out, so they can set up first strike possibilities if they ever had to go to war with Wakanda. That's what they're doing. But through a complicated scheme, that's what White Wolf reveals. But it's like, you could have just sent a memo. Instead, you do all this convoluted nonsense because you don't want to have to deal with your brother in a direct way.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all, so I get to examine a bunch of different things all at once. And basically just, and I ain't going to lie, a big part of it is just me flexing. Yeah, I know who Queen Divine Justice is. Y'all may not know, but I do, because I read Christopher Priest's run of Black Panther, and I loved it. And that's the canonical run for me as far as I'm concerned. You know, so that's, don't get me started. Well, I mean, even for me as a creative, I mean, it had ramifications all through genre. Period. So, for example, you know, all of a sudden, people are like, oh, Black Panther was a huge hit. Wait a second. Black people go to the movies. Wait a second. Black people read stuff. We need to make more movies and more books with Black people. Right?
Yeah,
that's what it's like. And once again, the rest of it is like, we've been doing this for a minute, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
sure.
But so all of a sudden, all these different entities quote unquote, find us and mm-hmm. discover us. And like, now our inboxes are full with all these opportunities that, you know, all of a sudden we have all these things that, you know, that we've been striving for our whole careers. And all of a sudden it's like a floodgates have been opened. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to get caught up in that floodgate. But, you know, but I have role models in the industry who are there to help. Oh, N.K. Jemisin, for example, in the firmament of writers for me, she's like right at the top. But, and she would talk about this, how, you know, how hard it was to get to this spot. And then once you're here, how much harder you have to work to stay in the game. So that's one thing. But then the whole, all of a sudden is, you know, her, you know, she would say things like, you know, they're acting like there's only five black people out here and all five of us, our inboxes are full. Mm-hmm. So what does it look like for those of us who are in these positions of success and who have quote unquote made it? What does it look like for us to leverage these opportunities for those who are coming up behind us? Mm-hmm. And so that's, again, where we come back to that whole idea of art meets social practice. And if we say this is what we're about, then we need to live out. That's what we're about. So, you know, the opportunity, if they hit my inbox like, yay, I can't do that. But, hey, I know someone who can. Let me put you on or let me put them on, you know, that sort of thing. And so
creating a legacy.
Absolutely. It's like, because we talk about it all the time, you know, we behind closed doors. We talk about it all the time. Like, yeah, Afrofuturism is hot right now. But, you know, we know how history works. You know, this door is open right now. It's not going to be hot forever. This door ain't going to stay open forever. So what do we do now in the meantime to create our own institutions to support ourselves so that when this door closes, well, actually, it could never quite close because our institutions that we've created hold that door open, not just for us, but again, for those who are coming up behind us. Mm.
Why is it so important to tell these stories?
Well, I know for me, one of the big things for me is like, I'm telling the stories I wish I could have read when I was coming up because they weren't there. They absolutely weren't there. I love, I mentioned I have this huge love of mysteries. That love of mysteries started when I was a kid. You know, I loved Encyclopedia Brown. I loved Danny Dunn. But, you know, I was just like, Danny Dunn is a science detective. I know I was like one of the six people who ever bought that book series. I get it. But that was it for me. I love the Danny Dunn science mysteries. But I didn't have books that had people that looked like me in it. And so that's why, you know, as a, you know, I start writing middle grade books because I want to feature some students who look like me as the characters in these books. Again, just stories I wish I had when I was coming up. My sci-fi series, all that stuff I wish I could have had when I was coming up. So, yeah, so that's why I think it's important to tell the stories. And then all the way going back to what my mother said. This is how we pass down our culture. This is how we pass down our history. This is how we pass. This is our cultural legacy that we're communicating back and forth. How do I partake in that tradition of continuing to pass on our stories, our history, our art?
Saturday, August 3rd, 2024, the dead astronaut is going to be brought back to Earth. She wanted to be buried on Mars. She said that when she realized she was dying. She said Mars was the one thing she had wanted all her life, and now she wanted to be a part of it forever. But the Secretary of Astronautics says no. He says her body might be a contaminant. Idiot. Can he believe that any microorganisms living in or on her body would have a prayer of surviving and going native in that cold, thin, lethal ghost of an atmosphere? Maybe he can. Secretaries of Astronautics don't have to know much about science. They have to know about politics. Theirs is the youngest cabinet department, and already it's fighting for its life. Christopher Morpeth Doner, one of the men running for president this year, has promised to abolish it if he is elected. My father agrees with Doner. Bread and circuses, my father says when there is space news on the radio. Politicians and big corporations get the bread, and we get the circus. Space could be their future, I say. I believe that. As far as I'm concerned, space exploration and colonization are among the few things left over from the last century that can help us more than they can hurt us. It's hard to get anyone to see that, though, when there's so much suffering going on. just outside of our walls. Dad just looks at me and shakes his head. You don't understand, he says. You don't have any idea what a criminal waste of time and money that so-called space program is. He's going to vote for Donner. He's the only person I know who's going to vote at all. Most people have given up on politicians. After all, politicians have been promising to return to us the glory, wealth, and order of the 20th century. Ever since I can remember. That's why the space program is about these days, at least for politicians. Hey, we can run a space station, a station on the moon, and soon a colony on Mars. That proves we're still a great, forward-looking, powerful nation, right? Yeah, we're barely a nation at all anymore, but I'm glad we're still in space. We have to be going someplace other than down the toilet, and I'm sorry that astronaut will be brought back from her own chosen heaven. Her name was Alice Cataline Gaudens Leal. She was a chemist. I intended to remember her. I think she can be a kind of model for me. She spent her life heading for Mars, preparing herself, becoming an astronaut, getting on a Mars crew, going to Mars, beginning to figure out how to terraform Mars, beginning to create sheltered spaces where people can live and work now. Mars is a rock, cold, empty, almost airless, dead, yet it is heaven in a way. We can see it in the night sky, a whole other world. But too nearby, too close within the reach of the people who have made such a hell of life here on Earth.
Let's talk about Unfadable.
So Unfadable is my second middle grade detective novel, and it follows a young lady. Her name's Isabella Fades. Bella to her family, Unfadable on the streets. She tags. That's her thing. Is, you know, she's a tagging artist, and she's just trying to find money to do a summer program where she can, like, you know, benefit the community and get the summer thing going so that other artists can learn what it looks like to do murals and tag things and things like that. But in the course of this, her just trying to find the, you know, so a little bit of change to do this program, she uncovers this level of neighborhood corruption in terms of how money flows through the neighborhood. And then she has to figure out, well, I'm just a teenager. You know, how can I do anything about this? So she becomes mentored by some folks. I call him my retired Batman figure. but he's an older dude in the neighborhood, and he takes young people under his wing to train them in leadership skills, and then lets them figure things out. So he takes Bella under his wings, you know, to try and teach her the skill set so that she is in charge of uncovering all of this on her own. So it's all about agency and action. Now, this is from the opening chapter of Unfadable. Yeah, so this is being the introduction that you're going to get some brief introductions to my main cast in here. I tried to choose something where I could just, like, let me hint at all the main characters that are going to be in this book. So this is chapter one of Unfadable. As I inspect my handiwork, I keep shaking my spray can. Not quite a nervous habit. I just like the way it rattles in my hand, like I'm a snake warning everybody that I'm out and about. The alternating red and green letters have black flames around them, spelling my name out along each pillar along the I-65 overpass, creating this sort of a 3D echo of a word. I don't just see colors, I feel them. Colors are all potential. They can be anything. It's all about how you mix them. My name is Isabella Fades. You know, a little bit of black mixed with a little bit of white. My friends call me Bella, but out here on the streets, I'm known as Unfadable. Okay, not my best work, but it'll do for now. Definitely not bad for a 13-year-old, if I do say so myself. Summer vacation's only as fun as you make it, you know? If I can't come up with my own adventures, I'd be stuck in a house complaining about how bored I am. That ain't me. I figure out what I have to do. Still, you know, going to this meeting is more a matter of survival. But I'm mostly going because I was promised there'd be snacks. And I can't say I'd ever much noticed the old Indianapolis Public Library number 1 building, you know, not much before summer. You know, with the number 1906 chiseled into its cornerstone, it looked like another house overgrown with weeds and ivy. Miss Campbell's on some committee to see about getting it on some sort of historic registry because it's like the oldest library building in Indianapolis or something. Since it's on our block, the city had forgotten about it. But she organized folks to help refurbish it into a community space. And me being here is also her fault. She's always on me to do more stuff for the community, like she's the neighborhood cheerleader. You know, where do you think you're going? You know, like some bouncer, this big dude's by the door holding up a hand huge enough to crush coconuts. He has a barrel chest and his face resembles a mug that's been broken and glued back together poorly. Into the meeting? Yeah, I don't think so. His voice is full of enough steel to build a cage, like when my teachers want to sound serious. You know, I think I'm supposed to be scared. This here is grown folk stuff. I know. Miss Campbell invited me. I try to peek around him, but every time I move, he steps into my view. Yeah, I don't think so. Even his voice sounds like he's looking down his nose at me. I mean, he is, since he's nearly 2 feet taller than me, but he doesn't hide the fact that he's dismissing me. And I hate not being taken seriously. Hate it. But every now and then, my best play is to give them what they expect. I make my lip tremble, you know, just a level one tremble, you know, subtle but noticeable. A level three lip tremble risks looking too over the top, and he might not buy it. Yeah, my mom told me to meet her in here, and I don't see her, and she told me to wait for her. With a sigh, he first stares me up and down, then he softens, slightly. No one with feelings can take the lost little girl routine, no matter how tough they pretend to be. Look, stay in back. Don't make any noise. Okay, thanks. Like what? I'm going to shoplift a speech or something? I'm pretty sure everyone learns from middle school how to move through life. You know, this meeting reminds me of a typical day in the life. You know, people gather in small packs, either with their friends or with other popular kids. You know, each person tries to appear real important to everybody else. You know, like peacocks strutting around, you know, ready to stop and take a selfie at a moment's notice. You know, the grown folks in here ain't no different. You know, already bored, I shuffle off towards the back, you know, near the aisle, already to make a quiet and quick exit if I need to. You know, an older kid, you know, maybe 15, sits down next to an old man, you know, probably his granddad who dragged him in here. I already can't stand him. Hot as it is outside, he's got his leather jacket on. You know, that thing is leather, and it's still summer in Indiana, but he needs the world to see. He's big and lumpy, probably a football lineman. Plus, he's got the nerve to manspread his janky legs like he owns a place. Over here thinking he's cute, but he looks like a chubby spider monkey. What's up? He gives a single, cool flick of his chin and scoots away from me like he's trying to give me room. Aries Grayer. Yeah, I didn't ask. Not wanting to study him any closer, I scrounge around in my book bag till I come up with a phone charger. Now that I'm inside, my mission is to find an outlet. Smirking, Aries nudges the old man. Now, I thought my complexion was light, but the old man's practically white compared to me. A mix of peach and tan, like a sun-warm sand. He's a sprawl of limbs tucked neatly into his chair. His collared shirt is unbuttoned, revealing a t-shirt touting a group called the Last Poets, who look like some great granddads of a rap group. The red leather fedora dips low on his head. The old man turns slightly. Even though the move is barely a glance, it's like he's taken me in completely. Settling by an outlet at the end of their row, I set my book bag between me and them like a wall and shift away so I can pay attention to the meeting. And there aren't any snacks, so now I'm really irritated. The old lady in the yellow hat breaks away from the group she was talking to. Her cane taps along the hardwood floor as she strides down the center aisle. Like a principal making an entrance, she hesitates, creating a show of nearing her seat, allowing people another minute to wrap up their conversations and head to theirs. She must always be expecting a meeting to break out at any second, since she takes a gavel from her purse. She smacks it once against the table, a sharp shot, like she fired a gun. Yeah, something's about to go down.
Where do you find the balance when you're creating and you're writing and doing these stories?
Ooh, yeah, balance. I'm not too sure if there's a thing of called balance. You know, I figure it's always a thing in flux. It's always something I'm continuing to try to work out. And it's a, you know what? Here's it. Balance is a continual conversation. One that starts with my wife. I've learned this lesson the hard way. Why don't I start the balance conversation with her, the main object and center of my orbit, right? So let me start with her and the boys, and that'll be my measure of balance. And then after that, like I work at a middle school and I work with Capra, but both those spaces value me doing my writing. So I have this very enviable setup where all my jobs support me as a writer because they go, you're a writer first. So we want to make sure you have room to do that. And then my work, you know, my work in those spaces, you know, I get to shape around my writing schedule. So that's the balance, is finding, you know, realizing who I am, what I need to do, and then finding spaces that let me do that thing. It's like, yeah, I can do this. I can be the librarian at the middle school. And by the way, here's some projects I'm going to do as the librarian. They're like, oh, yeah, no, we're good. We're good. With Capra, it's like, hey, my art is centered, my writing is centered, which makes me great in the cafe creative space, because then we can have these conversations of, you know, one artist to another. Here's what I'm struggling with. What are you struggling with? How can I support you? Here's how you could support me. You know, that sort of thing. So the balance is a continual conversation between me and my family, and then me and my jobs, and me and my community. Mm.
Where do you see Maurice Broaddus's future, and where do you see the future of Afrofuturism?
I think those two things might be interrelated. I think Afrofuturism, the future of it, is in, you know, I've already mentioned that it's where art meets social practice, but I see the future of that, those two being not just meeting, but being intertwined, you know? And so, so what does it look like? You know, I met you, you said I was a consultant for a video game project. Mm-hmm. That's great. What does it look like for us Afrofuturists to be consultants on civil projects?
Policy
projects. Planning committees, like all of a sudden, no, let's involve artists in every aspect of what's going on in our culture and society. What does that look like? That's where I think the future for I know that's the direction I'm heading in. And that's where I see my future at, being a storyteller, you know, telling these stories, these aspirational stories of here's what I'd like to see the world be like. And then in my work, let's work towards those futures. So it's like casting a vision, working towards that vision. That's where I see myself personally. And then also, you know, I see that's the future of the genre, that no, art is a valuable part of the human experience. And yet we try to leave it off in the corner somewhere, like, oh no, that's just what we do for entertainment. No. It's part of the human experience. So it needs to be wrapped up into all parts of the human experience. You know, in our economics, in our politics, in our school system, you know, it should be involved in all the different areas of our life, because it's fundamentally what makes us human. I keep everything nice and simple. So Maurice Broaddus. So my website is mauricebroaddus.com. My Facebook is Maurice Broaddus. My Twitter is Maurice Broaddus. My Instagram is Maurice Broaddus. Whatever the platform is, find Maurice Broaddus. I'm there.